My name is Ferdi Alanen, and my book is Glorious Exploits.
In his debut novel, Glorious Exploits, author Ferdi Alanen takes a fresh approach to his retelling of the Sicilian expedition, a time when thousands of Athenians were held prisoner in a Syracuse quarry. Alanen makes this 2,000-year-old story accessible through his use of contemporary Irish dialect. I recently spoke with Ferdi Alanen about his love of the classics, the power of art and drama, and narrating his own audiobook. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Ferdi Alanen. Could you give our listeners a description of the book? Could you set the scene for us?
Absolutely. So the novel is set in 412 BC, Syracuse, in the aftermath of Athens's invasion of Sicily. They think it's going to be very easy. They're going to conquer the island. And in the end, they end up as prisoners, thousands of prisoners, in this limestone quarry just outside of the city of Syracuse. And you can still visit that today. And the inspiration for the novel was a passage from Plutarch, where we learn that some of these defeated Athenians actually survived because their Syracusan captors were so obsessed with Athenian drama, and especially the work of the playwright Euripides, that it actually gave them food and wine in exchange for quotes from his plays. And Glorious Exploits follows two such Syracusans, two unemployed potters, Lampo and Gelon, who get it into their heads that they are going to put on a production of Euripides' Medea. And what adds urgency is the idea that Athens is going to lose this war, possibly be destroyed. And actually, they might, by putting on this play, actually save it from oblivion. And they discover there's a whole new Euripides play that no one in Sicily has seen. So that's essentially a very brief intro to the story.
You know, I'd seen that that was based on history, and I had no idea about that. And in fact, I feel somewhat ill-equipped for this interview, primarily because I've only read the Iliad and retellings of some epic poems. I saw you described in a review as a classics graduate. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah. So my undergraduate, I studied history and classics at undergraduate. So I do have a basis in it, but I'm not a classicist. But that was my original studies.
So are you more like Gelon, more into Euripides than Sophocles? I mean, like Medea and the Trojan Women, are these plays special to you?
Yeah, I love Sophocles as well, so I wouldn't be quite like Gelon. I wouldn't be as dismissive as Gelon. But Medea was one of the first of those ancient Greek tragedies that I read, and it struck me as so immediate and compelling and dark and strange. It just felt really vivid, the idea. This was written thousands of years ago, but it was so gripping, and that always stuck with me. And the Trojan Women I read a little bit later, and that is a very strange kind of dark play, but also singularly compelling.
I feel like we should tell listeners that it's a work of historical fiction, and we are looking at these plays being put on. But I want to talk about the voice that you capture for your characters, because the accents and the lines are all delivered with a distinctive Irish accent, and it's not an Irish setting at all, as you mentioned, but it really makes the book come alive. Why did you choose this approach?
Thanks so much. Yeah, that's a good question. I feel it will be one of the things that really strikes readers. It's set over 2,000 years ago, yet they sound like contemporary Dubliners. I did that for a few reasons. One, to make it jolt the reader. It would be, unexpected. But more than that, essentially, Syracuse was an island. It had been colonized a few hundred years previous to when the book is set by mainland Greece. So I was looking for parallels to that. And I didn't have to look very far. Ireland, where I'm from, you have Hiberno-English, where the kind of native structures of the Irish language in some way influence the kind of distinctiveness of the kind of Irish English. So I thought that was an interesting way of giving a sense of Syracuse's relationship with the rest of Greece. And I wanted to move away from that convention of, oh, this is the classical world. They're all going to sound like the lords from Downton Abbey automatically. I wanted to shake things up a little bit.
So, how do you balance writing humor with tragedy?
Cheers. Yeah. How do you balance it? I think, in a way, for me, like the tragicomic mode almost feels like the more authentic mode, in that like lived experience is can be very, very funny, and it can be joyful and exuberant, and then it can have this intense darkness. So to me, it's the balance of life. In addition, when I was, I also love Aristophanes. And if you read Aristophanes' comedies, they're almost like, reading Monty Python. It re reminded me of Monty Python. So that there's this raucous comedic tradition in ancient Greece, very different, I think, than the kind of like somber philosophical mode that we always associate. So I wanted to kind of blend, the depth of feeling from a tragedy, but also the comedic tradition.
Talk to me about the power of art and drama and song and story.
Yeah, well, I think is that was part of as well what drew me to this story, that anecdote from Plutarch about, the Athenians have just tried to conquer the island. They've been left in a quarry to die. And just that contradiction that you would dehumanize people to the point where you would leave them in that kind of situation, yet be so obsessed with their art and their drama, which is often about empathy. So yeah, for me, that is one of the things that art can do. It can transcend those lines of division. As Olampo says in the story, you can hate the people but still love their poetry. And I think that's always been true, and it's true today, its ability to kind of bridge the gap.
Let's talk about Lampo. Why choose to tell the story from his perspective?
That's a good question. Why did I tell it? Firstly, that was the voice that came to me. For me, I'm very led by voice and a perspective. And that, so Gellon says to me, the first, like, let's go down and feed the Athenians. I immediately had a character, even though it was the ancient past, it was like someone I grew up with in Dublin. I could see where he was coming from. Also, there's the typical way that we tell these stories of historical fiction in general, but especially classical set historical fiction. We either go for epic heroes from the myths or else epic heroes from history. So the amount of stories about Alexander the Great or potentially Socrates, etc. And I wanted to tell a story about the silent majority, and also give a sense that these plays, these tragedies, they were popular entertainment. This wasn't something that only the sophisticated elite would go to. This was the lifeblood of the community in many ways. And yeah, to that opened up, okay, it wasn't going to be from a famous politician, or it was going to be from a working class character. And one of the most key jobs in that period was pottery. And also then you had the connection with the myths, with the ancient Greek vases as well.
You know, the thing that always strikes me, so that the slave, the barmaid, I'm blanking on her name, Lyra?
Lyra.
Lyra.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think of the only epic poem I've read, the Iliad, or I guess it probably would come from the Odyssey, but like Briseis. I think of these women and just how intellectual and well-informed. I mean, Briseis was a queen, and then she was a slave. She was a gift given to Achilles. And then this Lyra was the daughter of a really brilliant man who could read, and she was sold as a slave. And I think that's always something I want to dig into, but I never have a question about. So I just, that's an observation. So there we go. Okay.
No, it's thanks very much. I think it's a very good observation. It's something I've thought about both when I was writing the book and then afterwards reading it. And it was something that I found very interesting about that period of history, that you would have often the slaves. It was a real example of the dice roll of history. You could be in a very elite position, you could be highly educated, and then the next week you're literally kind of scrubbing tables, because the war didn't go the way of didn't go the way of your community, as happens with Briseis, and certainly with Lyra. She's a lot more educated than Lampo, which is something that he finds quite difficult. He's aware of it, yet he's trying to, he's very proud of his status as a free citizen. And this is also the interesting aspect of Greek society. In some ways, if you read Greek history, Greek theater, it's incredibly relatable. And yet there's this alien quality to the society. They have democracy, but it's only, adult male citizens. Half the population are slaves. Women couldn't vote. They weren't citizens. So there is that strange blend of familiarity and strangeness with this period that that really interested me.
Okay, so I want to ask about the audiobook because I like to listen while I read. We recently spoke with an author who the narrator said the author's name wrong, mispronounced the author's name. And then another author recently, when I asked him about the audiobook, he refused to listen to it because he was afraid he was going to be disappointed. But this one, you read the audiobook. And I want to ask, was it important for you to read the audiobook? I mean, I imagine it really set the tone, and like the two main characters were immediately well defined, and I wonder if it had a lot to do with how you portrayed them.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. That's good that that the difference came across. It was a funny one. I was always resistant to audiobooks. I was living in Paris, so I'd have to travel, back and forth to work, and the metro was so busy I couldn't actually read. So I would listen to started to listen to audiobooks and just then kind of fell in love with it as a form. Most of my books I read, but I also listen a lot, and it then that idea got born of if I managed to get this book out there. I've lived with these characters for many years, that I would, they're very clear in my head that I would like to be able to do it. But I did have to audition.
You
I
did?
didn't just say, yeah, I had to read like a read a read a chapter, sample chapter, just to make sure. I didn't want to force myself upon my my audio publishers. I wanted to do what was right for the book.
Did the other actors auditioning have Irish accents?
Well, I suppose that is the thing. I by audition they I don't I didn't I don't know I don't know if they auditioned anyone else. It was like they tested to see if it would be.
Okay. Gotcha.
But I've seen that before where audiobooks by like Irish novelists, and they get like an English actor to do the Irish accent, and it's just a bit woeful. So at least we avoided that.
I want to ask about, I'm not sure if it's a recent thing or if it's been a continuation, but we seem to revisit mythology, and there are reimaginings and retellings about mythology. Why do you think we keep coming back to these stories?
Yeah. Why do we come back to these stories? I think to a certain extent it's part of it is just a carrying on of momentum. Like the more people retell a certain story, the more likely it's going to be retold and reinterpreted. Another layer, I just think the stories are very quite powerful. There's a potent psychological draw to them. And this is something that they were doing all the way back in the classical period. So Euripides didn't invent the Medea story. He actually was just retelling it. And in the original version, Medea didn't kill her children. That was like an innovation that he made. So this process is, we're just kind of continuing on, kind of doing what the Greeks were doing. So I think it's a blend of, they're very interesting. I think these stories are, they're complex enough that they can be vessels for different messages. They're not simplistic. You can interpret the like Madeline Miller with Circe. There's a way that you could read, even when you reread the Odyssey, you can read Odysseus as a hero, and then you can read him as a more gray, somewhat dark figure. And that's even in that's in the original story. So I think it's a very rich field for authors to go back and mine and find contemporary resonances in.
So I mentioned earlier that my lack of classical reading made me question myself. And I mean, I recognize names like Agamemnon and Ajax, but I'm wondering if classics graduates will get more out of the book having the built-in knowledge. Or do you see Glorious Exploits as approachable by all?
Yeah, I really feel that it's approachable by all, to get as many people to read it. But I genuinely believe that, and I think that's been the feedback so far, is that you don't, you know, of course there's little things that if you have a classics background, you might notice certain things, but that people who have no background or knowledge of this period or the myths still can find something in it. It's very much about these characters in this situation. And I feel like the themes, like war, friendship, the kind of the compulsion to tell stories, even in the most kind of dire of circumstances, these are things that will always be relevant. And yes, yeah, so I feel, yeah, you don't need a background at all to approach. Almost in the same way that you don't need a classics background to read the Iliad. If you pick up the Iliad and it's a good translation, I think you'll have a grand old time.
I think the translation is key.
It's true, yeah. It has to be the right one.
So, correct me if I'm wrong. This is your debut novel, correct? And I understand that you also write short stories. How do you approach writing each?
Yeah, I think novels are a lot more maybe about structure. You have to get it maybe before you embark on a novel. For me, I have to get a sense that the story has enough in it to sustain that longer narrative, really, in terms of just events, character. Whereas with a short story, you could really almost follow a feeling or an image and just see where it goes. And, you know, you could write a draft in a few days. So I think it's more, there's often more conscious initial work when it comes to a novel, just in terms of thinking through the whether it be the structure or just where it's going. I don't necessarily plot everything in detail at all, but I do have a good think about it before. Whereas with a short story, I'll just sometimes just sit down and start writing.
So what's next for you?
Yeah, what's next? I'm writing I'm into book two, which is also a work of historical fiction, but in a much later period. So we're moving to medieval France now. So taking my a little well, I lived in Paris, but not in the Middle Ages. But
Well, the book is Glorious Exploits. Ferdia Lennon, thank you so much for joining us today.
thanks a million, Beth, for having me.
That was Ferdia Lennon, author of the book Glorious Exploits, which was published by Henry Holt & Company. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.